Panel of speakers. First, we have Sean Guerin from Vote Solar, who's going to give us a lay of the land for this topic. Sean is the Northeast Regional Manager for Vote Solar, where he oversees policy campaigns in New York and New England, and he co-authored the low-income solar policy guide that he will be speaking about in his presentation. He has worked in states across the country and federally in clean energy and economic development policies and politics, and has specifically focused on economic fairness and equality and energy equality. So, Sean, we look forward to hearing your presentation. Go ahead.
Thanks. Thanks so much to the EPA and Victoria for pulling this together and everybody for hopping on. Based on the responses to the polls, I think my presentation will hopefully be quite helpful for folks. So to start off, if I can get this work, want to introduce Vote Solar a little bit. So our mission, a big part of our mission is basically to lead to bringing solar into the mainstream in order to really solve a lot of our energy problems and global warming as a global problem. And so a core part of our tenet is that we think if we decrease costs and we increase the amount of access to solar, we will obviously bring solar to scale. So we do that by targeting state-level opportunities for change through a pretty broad array of tools. So we participate in regulatory processes. We work with policymakers and educate policymakers on good and bad policy around solar and solar in general. We build local and diverse advocacy partnerships and coalitions. We provide technical analysis, tools, and resources to help both advocates and decision makers and regulatory bodies to make good informed decisions. And we run public communications and grassroots engagement campaigns to get the public engaged and ensure their voices heard. So that is Vote Solar real quick. My purpose here today is to give a quick overview of low-income solar policy. So I'm going to run through a low-income solar policy guide that was written by us and some other partners, talk about why this is an important thing to do, why do we want to expand access in low-income communities, some of the barriers to entry for low-income communities, guiding principles for how to formulate good policy, some of the policies that exist already that can be implemented to expand access to solar in low-income communities, and places where models are successfully playing out across the country, or fights to expand programs or adopt new programs are taking place. So the Low-Income Solar Policy Guide. We wrote the Low-Income Solar Policy Guide along with our partners Grid Alternatives. Stan, who's on this call as well, will tell you a little bit about the work they do, and the Center for Social Inclusion. And, you know, the polling results, I think, are a perfect example of why we wrote this policy guide. We know that folks across the country are interested in delivering the economic and environmental benefits of solar to low-income communities. But we also know that folks, for the most part, haven't started to do this. Most people are just trying to understand what are the barriers, why isn't solar expanding in these communities, and how can we work to expand that access. And we looked around the country and tried to pull out the working model, the working policies that are driving access across the country. So this guide is available as both a PDF sort of paper version, but also as a website. I see that it's actually wrong here on the sort of screenshot, but it's lowincomesolar.org. So it's pretty simple, lowincomesolar.org. You can go there and use the tool. The contents are basically sort of background on what's at stake here, why is this important, and what is it that's holding communities from engaging in solar already back. Guiding principles for how to move forward, policy tools, successful models, so states and cities that are moving ahead, and then impact highlights, so actual stories from folks on the ground who are benefiting from solar and what that means to them. The guidance in the site is designed to be really useful in a hands-on, policy-driven environment. And so it breaks down by policy tools and by models and breaks those down into different categories to help you figure out if you have a financing issue, you know, here are tools to solve financing problems. Each of these tools is also outlined by the barriers they address, by the guiding principles that they represent, and then they tie into the successful models and where these are actually being used and some of the results that we've seen already from these programs. So why ACT? I think you can summarize it pretty easily in these three, although there are so many more reasons to expand access to solar in low-income communities. So first and foremost, I think it's economic and environmental justice. You know, communities, low-income communities, communities of color across the country have been adversely affected by our energy system in the past. You look at where refineries or coal-fired power plants or, you know, transmission lines often are placed. The communities that are affected by the pollution, by the you know, economic drag that those can often represent, you name it, are in low-income communities. Those are placed in low-income communities. And so expanding access to solar in these allows us to proactively build a new energy future in which these communities are reaping the most or at least sharing in the benefits of this new energy future. They see the new jobs and training that come with solar programs. They see the environmental benefits of a cleaner energy system. They see the local investment and property taxes and you name it that come from distributed investment in communities. And they see the economic benefits to households that go solar. So they see the electric savings. They see the long-term property value increase. They're reaping those benefits. The next reason is just more solar. You know, I think a lot of us are committed to solving global warming, to re-envisioning our energy system to be more democratic down the line and in the future. And I think anyone who's committed to those knows that solar is right at the center of the fight to make that happen. And so expanding access is a key part of getting and delivering more solar to more folks across the country. And then finally, you know, from a political perspective, this is about building a stronger clean energy and climate movement. The more folks we can include from the get-go, the more people who are benefiting from the benefits or from the movement to solve global warming and to establish clean energy in our country, the more that we have a strong, diverse political force behind dragging this movement forward. So I think that's really critical. So let's talk about barriers to entry. I've broken it down into four sort of categories. Obviously, there are a lot of different issues that fit within these and a lot of other issues that may not be covered by these, but I think these are some of the primary ones. And I'll go into a little more specific. So cost sensitivity. Low-income communities, low-income individuals and families are, as you'd imagine, generally going to have less capital. And when you're talking about establishing a solar system on your roof or participating in a shared solar system, you know, there's a real cost to building, to buying those panels and putting them up on the roof or building that shared solar array. And so just access to capital is a core barrier to entry for low-income communities. Another is the need for savings sort of immediately and guaranteed and consistently over time. Most low-income individuals and families are more adversely affected by their energy bills than higher-income communities and higher-income income individuals. It's a larger portion of their expenses throughout the year. And so fluctuations in that, and you know, especially the idea that that could get any higher than it is now, has an extremely large impact on their quality of life and their likelihood to make the decision to go solar. And so we need to deliver savings up front, and we need to deliver savings over the long run in a predictable and consistent manner. And then sort of hanging off of that is the need to be insulated from unforeseen costs. So, you know, we need to make sure that low-income families, low-income individuals and communities are protected from, you know, adverse costs that could come down the line. So, again, it's about making sure that those savings, the economic benefits of solar are being delivered consistently over time. Next is access to financing. So this goes hand in hand with the lack of capital and some of the cost sensitivity. But basically, in our country, we have an unequal, inequitable system of financing. And, you know, if we're going to solve the problem of folks not having the money to put upfront to purchase a solar array, then we need to find some financing mechanism to allow that array to be built and allow them to benefit from it. This can happen either through loans to households or families directly, or, as is very often the case in our country right now in the solar world, it's loans and financing that go directly to the project developers who then handle that financing and provide a product to the household or family or individual that doesn't require them to put money down or has a very small upfront cost. The issue here is that our financing agencies are risk-averse, and the easiest and most understandable rubric for them to understand the risk involved with making loans that are dependent on individuals and families making payments is FICO scores. And credit scores, unfortunately, are not spread evenly across economic and racial boundaries. So if you look at folks who live in low-income areas, their FICO scores tend to be, and this is based on the Treasury, 44% lower than folks who live in higher-income communities. African American and Black Americans, 52% lower. Latino Americans, 29% lower. You name it, these scores are much lower. And so if you're expanding access to low-income communities and communities of color, you need to figure out a way to support financing that does not involve a credit check or as high of a credit check as traditional financing for solar or financing for most things, in fact. Some other issues, I think, around financing are the credit education. So a lot of the reason why low-income communities tend to have lower incomes or credit scores is just a lack of experience. They haven't taken out student loans necessarily. They haven't taken out as many credit cards, perhaps. There's a lot less actual sort of credit history in these communities. And as a result, or also to some extent, at the core of that is the fact that there's skepticism around lending and credit in a lot of low-income communities. They're concerned about predatory lending. They're concerned about digging themselves into a hole with debt. And so there's very much a need to help people understand the financing package that is allowing them to go solar and why it's constructed in a way that's safe and healthy for them. And then the last I would say is that there's less access to one of the core incentives for solar, which is the investment tax credit. Since many in low-income communities don't have significant income tax payments, income tax responsibility, it's very hard for them to count that tax credit because they don't have the appetite for it. And so you need to figure out a financing option that also includes someone taking advantage of the investment tax credit on their behalf and passing on some of those savings to those individuals and families. Physical barriers are an important one. I won't go too in-depth into this because I think people can understand it pretty easily, but the fact is most homes are not fit for solar. If you're in a multifamily home, it's hard to share a solar system under many electric utility systems. If you rent a home, then you don't own the roof and you can't make the decision to put solar on it in many cases. If you live in a city, you often have shading from surrounding tall buildings, and so your solar system's not going to be efficient enough, you name it. This is a big issue, and it's an especially powerful issue in low-income communities where you have a higher rate of multifamily homes, a higher rate of renting, and you have the additional issue of master metered housing complexes where many affordable housing, much of affordable housing is master metered, so there's one meter for the whole building, and then the landowner pays the rent or pays the electric utilities on behalf of the tenants, and so delivering positive economic benefits to the tenants becomes more complicated. The last one I would say here is just sort of condition and prioritization, and so in a lot of folks who do own their homes in low-income communities, there are a lot of priorities for where they put money and energy in terms of renovating and improving their homes. They might need to replace their windows or their boiler. They might need a new roof, and so solar might not be high on their priority list. The last is market forces. So this is just basically given all of these complexities and then the complexity of policies that try and address these, you have a market that is not necessarily chomping at the bit to go and work in low-income communities and deliver these positive benefits to low-income communities. There are enough moderate and higher-income families in the country who need to go solar that it's not, you know, it's not the top market, it's not the most exciting market for many companies and entrepreneurs. And so as we build policies and move forward, we need to keep in mind, how do we drive interest? How do we build a market for delivering these benefits to low-income communities? So this gets at our guiding principles. We essentially set these out, and they're in a little more description on the lowincomesolar.org. But we think that low-income solar policy should expand access and affordability of solar for more folks. They should engage communities and community partners. And so local NGOs, local churches, you name it, you know, you need to engage not just individuals and families, but the community groups and community organizations that organize those folks, that work with those folks, that are delivering benefits in other ways to low-income communities. Consumer protection is extremely important, again, given the cost sensitivity and the inability the fact that sort of unforeseen costs, unforeseen financial issues down the road are harder to sustain if you're a low-income person. We need to be especially protective of this community as we build a market there. Sustainability and flexibility, so just building a system down the line that can actually develop with the communities as they change and the makeup and the barriers might change over time. And then compatibility and integration, so building something that works with current solar policies that are on the ground and builds on them rather than replaces them. So here's the toolkit. If you look at these barriers and what needs to be addressed, we see a lot of different tools that can help with this. Virtual net metering and community shared solar allow more people, despite physical barriers, to access solar and more affordably. Incentives, net metering, financing, these help people to actually reap economic benefits from solar, sort of indirect incentives, so incentivizing developers to work in these communities, workforce development, consumer protection, and working with local groups on the ground helps to educate the community and to accelerate the market growth and accelerate the growth of work being done in low-income communities. And then finally, place-based programs, so building a set of policies around specific places and addressing their barriers and engaging with folks on the ground helps to really accelerate the result to protect communities and to address the specific physical and locational barriers in those communities. One thing to talk about real quick is community shared solar, which I know is a new topic for many folks. The basic idea, as we talked about, is that there's not that many folks, especially in low-income communities, that can just put solar on their own roof. And so a policy that helps to get around this is called community shared solar. And the basic idea here is you have three players. You have a developer, the subscriber, and the electric utility. And the developer builds a solar array in a local landfill or some local location, centralized location. They provide the good clean energy and other support services to the electric utility. The electric utility then supplies credits to the subscribers and the participants on their electric bill, so they see the benefit of that shared solar project. And then those participants and subscribers make payments to the solar developer to actually pay off the building of the project and the ongoing maintenance of the project. I'm not going to talk too long about successful models because Stan and Peter are going to give you some really great examples. There's more on our website digging into these, but these are some of the places where these specific markets have been really richly developed in low-income communities. And I hope you'll check out what they did and how they enabled that market growth. And then finally is a few places where project or policy debates are moving forward to continue or to start expanding access to low-income solar in low-income communities. So with that, I'll pass it off to the next speaker.
Thank you, Sean. That was great. Very comprehensive presentation, starting us off here with an explanation, a good explanation of the various barriers and some of the principles and successful models that are being used out there to overcome those barriers. Hopefully the rest of the presentations will help the listeners gain some knowledge as to how they can try to overcome those barriers themselves. Before we go on to Stan, we wanted to do another poll question, so please participate. This one says, which of the following barriers to entry poses the biggest challenge in your community? These are the barriers that Sean just talked about. Is it cost sensitivity, access to financing, physical barriers and home ownership, housing conditions, or market forces? It's hard to do, but please try to just select one, and we'll give you a minute to do that, please. Thanks. Okay, let's pull up the results. Okay, the majority of folks, by a slim margin, selected cost sensitivity. The next popular one at 28% was access to financing. And physical barriers and market forces were about equal, 16-17%, and housing conditions were 8%. Thanks for answering. It's obvious that we have work to do to overcome these barriers. We're going to go on to the next speaker, but I'd like to remind you to please enter your questions. We've already received several. Please keep them coming, entering them into the chat box.